Sterling Hundley is a painter and a professor in the School of Arts at Virginia Commonwealth University. He's illustrated for the likes of The New Yorker and the Grammys. So when NASA called on him, he brought his art students along to help the space pioneers improve their online messaging. Sterling, you've done a lot of commercial art for big names, The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Grammys, and others. Describe some of the illustrations you did for those groups.
Yeah, I kind of cut my teeth as a commercial illustrator, and my work's always been driven by ideas and trying to give them shape and form through drawing and painting. So a lot of editorial work, magazines, publications, book covers, some advertising work, but almost all of it in the first part of my career started off as commercial illustration.
Tell me about how you started with NASA. What was it NASA wanted from a commercial illustrator?
So the NASA project was interesting. I think it's always someone opening a doorway for you and an opportunity of something you maybe didn't imagine. My boss at VCU in the Communication Arts Department, his name is Ty Ruben Ellingson, and he saw my personal work, my drawings that were focused on documenting the effect of time on my family and familiar things. And he said, let me show you something. And showed me the work of illustrator Brian Sanders from the 60s, who had gone behind the scenes with Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey and documented the making of that. He said, you know, you should do that for SpaceX. And I said, yeah, I should. And that started this whole train of thought where I started to investigate what was happening, how I could connect with SpaceX, and found that they were doing the unmanned Dragon crew launch down in Florida, Cape Canaveral, at the NASA headquarters down there. I'd put a proposal together and convinced Ty and the dean to let me go down and actually embed myself there and document this experience.
Isn't it amazing how sometimes groups and workers doing their own work don't realize how much a spark of artistry can translate their work in a way they never could themselves?
You know, I've always thought about illustration and design as collaborative efforts, and the point is to make something greater than we can as individuals. And one of the gifts that artists have is our ability to manifest abstractions and to give shape and form to ideas. And you put us in a room of anybody, and we can be the people who are showing them ideas that are hard yeses or hard noes and give ideas traction.
You met somebody at NASA who said, let's talk a little bit more about another project we might be interested in.
The story is this. I was going down to Florida, and a friend of mine, a former student, gave me a call, said he was coming into town in Richmond, had a show. I said, well, I'm going to miss you, but didn't your sister work for NASA? And he was like, yeah, she sure did. Let me shoot her a text. And he did that. She reached out on my behalf. Nothing landed when I got down there. I made some connections myself and met some scientists and people who are involved with NASA. But it wasn't until, I guess, about 3 weeks later that she gave me a call and said, hey, Sterling, I've got a project for you. Let's talk about it. And that's where that relationship started.
And what did they want? What was nagging at them?
So I think what they had in mind was to bring us into a public kind of viewing of an autonomous drone program they were working on, dressing it up and kind of almost an arts and crafts type of thing where we would to build structures and paint them. And, you know, I think kind of thinking about artists in that capacity of, okay, they can make things, they can build things that can be visually interesting, and that can have an appeal to it. But our role changed pretty dramatically when we were invited to come out to NASA Langley, the base, just as a volunteer, just to sit in a kind of a blue sky discussion about what the event was actually going to be. So it was the engineers, the program administrators, and the scientists, and we were sitting in a boardroom. I went there with a colleague of mine, Jason Bennett, and I quickly kind of stood up and said, well, what if we did this? And I showed them something on the whiteboard and I could draw it. Then Jason came up to the whiteboard and he drew something that kind of built on that. And they said, wow, that's a completely different way of thinking about that than what we had in mind.
What did you write on that whiteboard that they were seeing that I can't imagine?
You know, it was just, it wasn't actually writing, it was drawing. And the thing about drawing was it's always a type of communication that cuts across backgrounds and geographic locations, time and context.
Is this the meeting where it was decided that there would be a course, a student course at VCU between VCU and NASA?
You know, it's interesting that this particular meeting that we were in, that had its own lifeline, it had its own project. What was interesting, just like any type of business opportunity, we ended the day and then we were invited to go to this little bar there at NASA Langley called Aftershots, and Afterburners, that's what it's called.
But it is Aftershots, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we took him up on it and we sat down with maybe six people from the team. The gal who brought us in started to talk about other problems they were trying to solve. She presented this idea that they had these things called top sheets, which were provided by the scientists who came up with inventions that they were trying to commercially license outside of NASA to the general public. And the statement was, it's really complex information that we're having a hard time relaying out to people to tell them what it is. And I said, you know, what we do as illustrators and designers is we make complex things simple. It would be really interesting if we actually got a bunch of students involved and made animations and illustrations and design work and websites, whatever it is, to actually help these things make sense to people when they read about them and when they see them. So that's where it started. And then it became a pilot class for these students to kind of jump into this this project that had real world application. The students came in, I think all they saw was like, well, Sterling's teaching this class that's connected to NASA somehow. And that was pretty much right. Pretty much it. And as they came in, it was, all right, so the first thing we need to do is we need to understand the problem. And a big part of my personal belief is that we need to connect physically to go into shared spaces and have dialogue with actual people to make these things work. So we were able to get the students out to NASA Langley as a big site visit. And we met three different scientists who were willing to work with us on helping to amplify and bring some attention to their inventions. And the students took notes and we got an incredible tour. We had an F-22 Raptor fly overhead and was doing its test flights. And we got to go to a 3D printed lab and just a really, really cool experience for all of us. At that point, we had to go back and assess where we could add value. The students, they were pretty intimidated at first, but I was able to give them a bit of structure to figure out, like, this is where we have the most value, this is what we can talk about, but before any of that happens, the thing that we need to work on the most and convince NASA that they need is a redesign of their website. And this was the tech transfer website. And when one of our teams committed to that and they started to design it, it became the spine and the central body of everything else that we were doing. Even though NASA hadn't asked us to work on that particular element, it was just absolutely critical to the communication.
It's so interesting that you saw something that NASA wasn't looking for, which is you definitely need a redesign of your website. In simple terms, what were you seeing and what were you and the students imagining?
Yeah. So it's interesting, you know, when you're working with students, they know what's current, they know what's interesting, they know what's engaging, and you have built into the students their own target audience. That is who NASA is trying to speak to, is the people who are going to be entrepreneurs and who are kind of changing the face of the country and of the world. Truly, the students across the board, just it was all their best work. And the team that was working on the website started off the presentation. We ended up not just giving that presentation to NASA Langley, but to the NASA agency nationwide. So they had people from DC and out in Texas and California all sitting on this final presentation. And at the end of it, NASA decided they wanted to take these ideas and implement them into the tech transfer portal, which again was the way that NASA engages with the public for the licensing of their intellectual property.
What did you suggest it be changed? In other words, how did we go from being a NASA portal to something that was appealing to younger people?
Well, it had to move. You know, pictures speak volumes, and not just pictures, but when you start to layer in the effect of sequence and time through animation and storytelling, then you have something that has an emotional connection to it. It has an application. We started to think about illustrations and case studies and just something that grabs people when they first come in, that holds their attention, that rewards them as they go deeper down that rabbit hole. So when you first come to the website, the students went all through NASA's collected database of videos going back to space research and aeronautics and everything in between. They've got a really rich and robust database of information that wasn't being used. So seeing those types of images when you first come to a NASA site, you want the site to look current. You want it to look like space. You want it to look like it's something that's going into the future, not something that's kind of been built in the past. So that was a big part of it, just getting that video up front. I am a champion for putting an artist at the table with the scientists, the policymakers, the politicians, the engineers, because we have a unique capability to envision the future.
Are the students that you have artists and illustrators, or are they web designers with an artistic flair?
We actually get students across the board. So in communication arts, we get designers and illustrators, people who want to go into entertainment arts, that want to go into book, into print. It really is applied art with drawing at its core. And so I think that it starts again with just understanding that drawing is a language, and it's a universal language.
It's wonderful. Sterling Hundley, thank you for talking with me, and with good reason.
It's been my pleasure.
Sterling Hundley is an illustrator and professor in the School of Arts at Virginia Commonwealth University. A lot of futuristic technology is already here. Think about it. Kids have drones for toys, and even grandparents get a turn at the Oculus virtual reality headset. David Bowles worked at NASA for 40 years. Now he directs Old Dominion University's VISA program, the Virginia Institute for Spaceflight and Autonomy. He says some space technologies, like autonomous vehicles, are getting more terrestrial. David, who around the world right now is doing the most groundbreaking work with autonomous devices? What has captured your attention?
Well, I think it's really permeating everything we see. Alexa in your house, to the Roomba vacuuming your floors. So it's permeating all aspects of what we do. And then things we do in space. Most of the things we do in space are autonomous. Lots of new companies are getting into this field, and it's exciting.
Recently, the James Webb Space Telescope was launched. What impressed you about the autonomy of that device?
So just the amount of it's launched in a stowed configuration and then on its way to its final destination. You know, the sun shield deploys, the solar panels deploy, the mirror, the segmented mirror deploys. It's really quite an engineering feat of how this thing deploys. And it's going to allow us to look back into the origins of the universe. It's going to be truly an amazing instrument, and really looking for it. I mean, I just think about all the pictures that we see from the Hubble Space Telescope, which has been an amazing asset.
What have you read is likely just over the horizon for us? What will we be automating in 5 or 10 years?
Right now, a lot of the drones, if you go to a hobby store and just buy a drone, you're really, the human is kind of controlling that. I think you're going to see them for certain applications where they're really thinking for themselves and making decisions at some level. You see that in the military. I think a great example of that, both with things that fly, but also things that either drive on the ground or go in the water, whether it's an autonomous boat or an autonomous underwater vehicle. You're gonna see them do more and more activities where the human gives the broad parameters, and then the vehicle starts to do that and is able to make decisions along the way. Perfect examples, emergency response and rescue is a great example of where you're using now a machine instead of putting somebody's life in potential danger in a hazardous situation, whether it's looking at a toxic spill or something like that. If you jump ahead, you know, maybe 10, 15 years, so I remember the Jetsons and George in his flying car. I think we're close to that, where you're gonna see piloted small kind of flying cars, but then at some point, I think you're going to see more of an autonomous operation the other piece I want to touch on is just smart houses, smart cities, smart campuses, smart infrastructure, maintenance and repair, and as opposed to letting something break and then having to go fix it. So it's just growing and growing in all aspects.
In your position as director of the Virginia Institute for Space Flight and Autonomy, in some ways that's a fledgling institute, coordinating the brain power and the institutions nearby, including the U.S. Navy and the largest port in the world, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's a huge Department of Defense footprint in the Hampton Roads area. There's also a large commercial port, one of the largest ones on the East Coast. And then we have two NASA facilities. We also have a spaceport where you can launch to orbit. That's pretty unique right now. Right now, there are only four places in the United States that you can launch all the way to orbit, and one of them's on Virginia's Eastern Shore. These things are gonna happen. We can be part of that and help drive it and help lead it and reap the benefits of it, or we can sit on the sidelines. And I'm much more for being proactive and being a part of leading that and reaping the benefits of it. We're actually working with the Port of Virginia to look at, okay, are there applications for autonomous vehicles for port safety, security, emergency response type things? So if you have a hurricane and you have some debris in the channel that's closing, you know, the shipping lanes in the port. Right now, a lot of that is monitored and found by people in boats. Can we deploy autonomous surface and undersurface vehicles to look for those kind of things and do it much more rapidly? We've just started some conversations with the city of Virginia Beach to look at, okay, how can autonomous vehicles can help the life-saving lifeguard experience? Not replace the lifeguards, but just enhance their effectiveness. Look for, swimmers in distress, maybe identify riptides.
How about alerting for sharks?
Well, that's a very interesting one. We actually did a little research and got on the phone with Australia. They've actually been doing this for quite a while. And one of their big problems is shark detection. Kind of the analogy to looking at sharks is looking at riptides. So you can be flying up and down with a camera and identify where the riptides are from above quicker than you could see it from the coastline.
What about the recent case where Storm shut down I-95, one of the nation's major thoroughfares, and thousands of people were trapped in their cars for more than a day in many cases? Could autonomous devices be useful in those circumstances?
Yeah, it's certainly easy to envision emergency response delivering supplies and things to people that have been stranded, you know, 15, 20 hours out of water, out of food, out of heat. Are there some autonomous vehicles that you could get to them and then get them out of their car, but at a minimum, deliver maybe needed supplies if it had been in there a very long time?
That's interesting. Imagine a system where 911 includes the ability to go to a map, identify an area where people are trapped in their cars, right?
Yes.
And you have a fleet of drones like the National Guard, but they're autonomous devices that are sent with supplies and equipment to each vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah, that is doable.
How much of an economic driver do you think this field is?
Big. As the number of applications grow, I think you're going to see more and more companies developing these vehicles. It cuts across everything. Agriculture. We haven't talked about agriculture. Or looking at the coastline for sea level rise and coastal resiliency. There are another couple applications that we've actually done some work in. But you're going to see, as the demand grows, you're going to see growth in the industry to support that demand. There's the opportunity to collect lots of data, whether it's from a drone or whether it's from an autonomous surface vehicle on the water or on the land, or even all the way up in space. All of these things are collecting data. Well, how do we get this data back to in decision in policymakers' hands, where you don't have to be a data scientist to understand it? Take an example, maybe real estate. Hey, maybe we should build here. If we look at what's flooded over the last so many years, you know, things like that, where to plant. So there are tremendous applications. So on the data side, it's not just the vehicle side. I think there's tremendous economic opportunities on the data side as well.
There's also the downside. I mean, aren't drones and autonomous devices all mostly various kinds of glorified spying gear? Isn't there a psychic cost of never feeling unseen or alone? Don't you want to be able to climb a mountain or travel through a forest and think there's not some Nest camera around every turn?
Yes, I do. And that's why one of the things I love about living on the Eastern Shore, I'm in a very rural location. I do feel like I've got that solitude when I need it. And I think we can manage that. I don't think that's not the one thing I'm worried about. I don't think we're going to get to the point where you don't have that solitude. But it's a great question, and it's worth asking. And it's worth asking to make sure we think about that as we integrate these systems into everyday life, because I think everybody would agree, we don't want to lose that ability. You don't want to feel like you're being looked at all the time. So, I mean, I've been involved in advanced technology and research development focused on aerospace for the last 40 some years. And I think, you know, as technology evolves, I think, you know, we've seen that in the past. And again, I think it's how we as society manage that, if you will. We don't want to lose control. But there have been technological leaps of things in the past. I mean, when computers first got here, we humans don't want to lose the control. We want to use technology to make our lives better, not lose control of it. And there's a risk there. So we've got to keep we can't ignore that. We got to keep an eye on that.
Well, David Bowles, thank you for sharing your insights with me on With Good Reason.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It was a pleasure.
David Bowles is director of VISA, Old Dominion University's Virginia Institute for Spaceflight and Autonomy. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, a National Cancer Institute designated cancer center, researching and developing the treatments of tomorrow, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up, we have American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.